content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is G-S-U-G-G-S. Insurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Time Magazine editions of December 29, 2025, and December 8, 2025. The latest issue of Time Magazine that's available today is dated December 29, and as usual, the front cover includes the bright red border with the white inner border. Person of the Year is the theme of the cover and of much of the content. Time is in large block lettering in a gray-blue superimposed upon an even paler gray-blue background. It features AI, the architects of AI. So in this scaffolding illustration, which is probably AI-generated, there is an A and an I, and it's very mechanical-looking. The properties remaining in that edition are from Time's Choices of the Best of Culture. So I'm going to be reading, first of all, from Judy Berman's TV reviews. And these lists will be abridged with just a sampling from each. So, for TV, by Judy Berman, The Pitt, HBO Max. If ER nostalgia drew viewers to Noah Wiley's hospital homecoming, what kept us riveted through its first season were storylines that resonated in the present. There's no equalizer like an emergency room, at least till the bill arrives, where plagues ranging from gun violence to misogyny to a fraying safety net catalyze life-threatening crises. To the extent that this series constitutes comfort viewing, one reason is it indulges the timely fantasy that no matter how broken our society gets, competent, caring people will always work through their exhaustion to cure what ails us. The studio, Apple TV, Hollywood loves making art about its devolution. This comedy is TV's best entry into the subgenre yet. Casting co-creator Seth Rogen as a doofy, insecure, idealistic, but cowardly studio head, trying futilely to make good movies amidst cutthroat colleagues played by Catherine O'Hara, Ike Barinholtz, Catherine Hahn, and Chase Swee Wonders. The show is truly funny. It uses A-list guest stars to great effect. Its film homage are on point. But what sets the studio apart is its genuine reverence for cinema, which cuts through the cynicism about the business of movie making that fuels so many similar stories and gives stakes to the characters fumbling. M.O., Netflix, the final season of Mo Ammer's semi-autobiographical series begins in Mexico City and ends at an Israeli airport. In both scenes, his alter ego, Mo Najjar, endures an infuriating encounter with a border enforcement bureaucrat. They are apt bookends for 8 darkly comic episodes that trace his Palestinian refugee family slog through the U.S. immigration system. Mo has a quintessentially American life, rooted in a multicultural community whose relative harmony offers an alternative to immigration hell, a vision of borders transcended rather than policed. That it comes from one of few Palestinian American voices with a national platform at a time of such great suffering in his homeland makes it all the more affecting. Turning the page now to the Best of Culture books by Lucy Feldman, Again, this is a sampling. A Guardian and a Thief by Megha Majumdar. In near future Kolkata, food is scarce, violence is escalating, and Ma is ready to get out. Her husband has set up a life in Michigan, and all Ma needs to do to join him is attain the 3 passports and climate refugee visas that she, her father, and her 2-year-old daughter, Mishti, have been approved for, and get her family on a plane. But someone from the shelter where Ma works as a manager has his eyes on her. Boomba, who has his own family to think about, envies what few comforts Ma has. And when he breaks into her home to steal food and cash, he unwittingly takes the trio's documents and their hope for escape with him. In her National Book Award shortlisted follow-up to A Burning, Megha Majumdar sets 2 families on a crash course, testing the weight of their morals against the strength of their love. A Marriage at Sea by Sophie Elmhurst. Morris and Marilyn Bailey, a married couple, were hankering for an adventure when they bought and boarded a boat in the early 1970s, set for a multi-year voyage from England to New Zealand. But nothing could have prepared them for the harrowing journey that followed. 9 months into their mission, a whale sank their vessel, and the Baileys found themselves adrift on a raft in the Pacific Ocean, where they would flounder under incredible strain for 118 days. British journalist Sophie Elmhurst tells the true story of a couple who survived against the odds, taking as much interest in the interpersonal dramas that played out between them as in the trials of being lost at sea. Katabasis by R.F. Kuang. 2 postgraduate students in Cambridge University's Department of Analytic Magic follow their recently deceased advisor to the afterlife in hopes of retrieving his soul. In Katabasis, R.F. Kuang, a Ph.D. candidate herself, conjures a fantasy quest narrative that gleefully skewers the lopsided power dynamics in academia. It is a campus novel where the campus is literally hell. Kuang consults everything from Dante's Inferno to mind-bending logic concepts like the impossible Penrose Stairs to create the landscape and mechanics of her underworld. Then she throws 2 desperate, competitive students into its depths to see whether they can find their way back to the land of the living, and if, along the way, they might learn something more valuable than what can be gleaned from textbooks. Turning the page again to Best of Culture Albums by Jen Pelly. Again, a sampling. Looks by Rosalia. For her 3rd full-length release, the Spanish pop visionary sings in 10 languages, collaborates with the London Symphony Orchestra, and communes with sacred teachings of nuns and female saints. Her immersion into cross-cultural divinity takes root in vanguard beats, searching timbre, and a colossal operatic voice attuned to pop iconoclasts like Björk, featured on Lux, and Kate Bush. Rosalia's religious inquiries, more art concepts than actual consecration, shapeshift through the sing-song kiss-off La Perla and Sufi mysticism-inspired La Jugular, which samples an archival Patti Smith interview. It's a beautiful place. Water from your eyes. This experimental indie missive from the New York duo of vocalist Rachel Brown and multi-instrumentalist Nate Amos is a delightfully uncanny soundtrack for fast walking through the city, contemplating the current horror show reality and the fact, despite it all, that Earth still really is a beautiful place. Accordingly, Water From Your Eyes, Proggy, Taunt, Alt-Rock, Bricolage, captures a certain existential absurdity. Between Amos's high-watt riffage, nothing's funnier than a guitar solo, he has said, and Brown's deadpan poetics, which approach rapping on the highlight life signs, Water From Your Eyes is architecting its own definition of indisputable cool. Iris Silver Mist by Jenny Hall. The music of Norwegian art pop hero and novelist Jenny Hval is as adventurous as it is incisive. Hval's episodic songs brim with intertextual references, conceptual grist, and spoke-sung experimentation, but never stray far from melodic pleasures. Her latest is inspired in part by a pandemic-era fascination with scent. The title references a favored perfume. That's Iris Silver Mist. Hval's restless melodies and Proustian lyrics trail cigarette smoke or the fragrance of roses toward litanies of memory, while deconstructing the nature of stage performance, recording technology, and digital existence. And that closes the cover on that latest of 2025 edition of Time. The next, going backwards, is from December 8, 2025. Again, the usual format of the cover, red and white borders, Time in a dark gray superimposed upon black with green splotches, and the partial body of a turtle. The first article I will read is under the heading Health, A Losing Game. In simulations across the country, students are proving we are not ready for the next pandemic. This is by Dominique Mossbergen, Orem, Utah. Let's see if there's another. Nope, that's the only reporter, writer. On a Friday morning in October, about 100 high school and college students gathered in a Utah ballroom to play a game. Some students were assigned specific roles and given costumes to wear. Government officials slung ties over their t-shirts. Store clerks sported aprons. A trio of journalists wore fedoras and carried fake microphones. Cambry Carlisle, 16, played a healthcare worker and was given full protective gear to wear, including goggles and gloves, as students started getting sick with a mysterious and deadly pathogen. Panic surged, Carlisle says. It was not a real scenario, but people still got very frantic, she says. Students thronged the healthcare and public health stations for advice and vaccines, ignoring calls by workers to socially distance. One infected student ran around intentionally coughing on people, causing panic. One of the journalists, 17-year-old Kennedy Burlingame, complained it had been hard at times to get anyone to listen to her. The public health people told us, we need to start getting people to quarantine. But I felt like no one really did that. They did not see the importance in it, she says. That was frustrating. Meanwhile, the biomedical researchers who donned white lab coats and were tasked with identifying the pathogen were baffled by the myriad symptoms that sick people were reporting, including fever, aching muscles, malaise. It could be anything, one of them lamented, as she Googled people's symptoms and uncovered a long list of possible diseases. The students were playing Operation Outbreak, a game that simulates the spread of an infectious disease. During the game, participants use an app on their phones, which alerts them when their avatars are infected and lists their symptoms. The pathogen spreads via Bluetooth from phone to phone. Creators of the game say it can model how people really behave when disease outbreaks strike. The game has become so good at this that U.S. government agencies, including the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, have run its simulations. In Utah, students who were not given specific roles were designated as members of the public and grouped together in families. The families moved around the room together, visiting stations where they had to answer questions about infectious diseases and public health. The bank paid the families in tokens for correct answers. The tokens could be used by the students to buy food from the store to keep their avatars alive, as well as masks and vaccines. I thought it'd be just a little school activity, but it was realistic, says Burlingame. It made me feel sympathetic for people during COVID. Burlingame was in fifth grade when COVID first gripped the globe in 2020. I just remember that one day I was at school and everything was normal. And then the next day the world had shut down, she says. She remembers it seeming almost apocalyptic at first. The same week that Utah public schools were shuttered, the Salt Lake City area where she lives was shaken by an earthquake and dozens of aftershocks. Burlingame, then only 11, was spooked. Some 5,400 people died from COVID in Utah from 2020 to November 2023. The teenager is prudent when reflecting on that tumultuous time. There could be another outbreak, she says, and what would we do about it? The creators of Operation Outbreak say the game is designed precisely to address this question. It seeks to teach students about the science and risks of infectious diseases and how interventions such as vaccines and quarantining can curb their spread, says Todd Brown, a former middle school teacher and one of the game's co-creators. It also aims to highlight the vital roles that every member of society, whether scientist, doctor, government official, or everyday person, plays when outbreaks strike. This is a test run, Brown says. This is a chance for students to learn how they can potentially save lives, how they could help stop the spread of something in their school or community. Upping the urgency for such preparedness is the prediction by many public health experts that another pandemic is not just inevitable, but close at hand. We need to be prepared for another pandemic in the next 10 years, says Pardis Sabeti, an infectious disease professor at Harvard University and researcher at the Broad Institute, who helped create Operation Outbreak. COVID was still a distant unknown threat when the game launched in 2017. Versions of it have since been played by thousands of students in 24 U.S. states and 10 countries. Its creators say interest in the game increased sharply post-COVID. We have found that the students tell us the zeitgeist. They tell us the pulse of society, everything that might be coming, Sabeti says. We could have predicted a lot of what happened during COVID based on simulations that we did pre-pandemic. Students in pre-COVID simulations spontaneously came up with immunity passports, ways that participants could prove their vaccination status to get into certain spaces. Participants also hoarded supplies, broke quarantine, even intentionally tried to become super spreaders, a phenomenon later also seen during the pandemic. We saw chaos, protests, people acting out, Sabeti says. Outbreaks expose and exploit all the cracks in our society. Any kind of injustice or issues you have are going to go on steroids, and that's what we saw in these simulations. In some cases, students who had roles of authority disseminated information about the outbreak that later proved to be wrong, often because they spoke too soon in response to public pressure or because new information later became available. That showed students how science can change as you get new information, says Brown, the former teacher who now serves as Operation Outbreak's Director of Innovation and Training. But the fluctuations in messaging often triggered malcontent among members of the community. Game organizers say mistrust of officials, scientists, and journalists has only become more common in simulations post-COVID. Participants are also more prone to unruly behavior. At some of our schools, we've seen complete societal breakdown, anarchy, militia, Sabetti says, and that was despite students taking the game seriously. These things we had not seen before COVID, Sabetti says. She recalls, for example, a March 2024 simulation at a Utah high school that ended in total chaos. After the government struggled to fund health agencies and researchers were slow to identify the pathogen, disorder and misinformation swelled. A journalist spread fake news about masking, people began stealing from the store, and a government official went rogue, robbing the bank and throwing tokens at a crowd. I represent government intervention, he declared, according to an internal report of the simulation compiled by game organizers and shared with Time. Money to the people. Amid the bedlam, participants called for a police force to be established, and a jail was created. The government official who stole from the bank was impeached. About an hour into the simulation, the new police force issued arrest warrants for multiple people, including someone who sold fake vaccines to make a profit, said the report. At 80 minutes, as the simulation came to an end, the report said several students were running and fighting each other, some arresting others. It scared me, says Sabetti. It suggests society has formed antibodies to the idea of an outbreak. People are easily triggered, so the next time someone comes on the television and says, "We are having a lockdown," we could see militia and anarchy. Since the COVID pandemic, Americans have lost faith in previously respected institutions. Almost one in four U.S. adults said in 2024 that they had little or no confidence that scientists would act in the best interests of the public, according to a Pew Research Center survey. In 2019, that figure was one in eight. Only 22% of Americans said they trusted the federal government to do the right thing always or most of the time, according to a different Pew survey from 2024. We need to do a lot to repair because when the next pandemic hits, we will be in trouble, Sabetti says. Pandemics are expected to occur more often and become more deadly because of climate change, globalization, more frequent encounters between people and the billions of livestock we raise to eat, as well as wild animals whose habitats we've diminished, public health experts say. It's going to be less of a freak biological occurrence and more like hurricanes, which are increasing and becoming more devastating, says Jennifer Nuzzo, director of Brown University's Pandemic Center. It is hard to predict which pathogen could launch the next global health crisis, but infectious disease experts say they're closely watching various outbreaks worldwide for signs of pandemic potential. A rapidly mutating strain of Mpox continues to spread across Africa and beyond. Avian flu strains are circulating in livestock and poultry, with some spillover in people. A manufactured pathogen is also a danger, Sabetti says, thanks to advances in biotechnology and AI. A single rogue actor can now feasibly create a bio threat, and because of that, anything is possible, she says. Operation Outbreak was first conceived in 2015. Ebola was ravaging West Africa, and Brown was a civics teacher in a Florida middle school. One day a student in his class asked what would happen if Ebola came to the U.S. I responded honestly. I said, I have no idea, Brown recalls. So I posed the question back to the class, and we had this exciting discussion. Encouraged by his students' enthusiasm, Brown brainstormed ways to further engage them on the subject of infectious diseases. It was a topic that was deeply personal to him. Brown's son is severely immunocompromised, and outbreaks, including the yearly flu season, terrify his family. Brown had recently read a profile of Sabeti, who'd helped develop tools to detect and track deadly diseases, including Ebola, in an issue of Time. Brown emailed her, and the pair ended up on the phone. He told her he was planning to put together a simple outbreak simulation so his students could get some hands-on experience. Sabeti, who had herself experimented with outbreak simulations in her Harvard classes, asked him to stay in touch. A few months later, Brown assembled some middle schoolers in a field and, using stickers to indicate who had been infected, attempted to simulate what an Ebola outbreak might look like. It was not very sophisticated, but the kids loved it, Brown says. I reached back out to Pardis with pictures, and it all kind of snowballed from there. Sabeti says she saw an opportunity to create something fun, educational, and sorely needed. Her lab set about designing an Operation Outbreak app that could realistically mimic an outbreak. Andres Calubri, a researcher in her lab, had been working on contact tracing software, which he adapted so it could be used as part of the app to spread a hypothetical pathogen via Bluetooth. With the help of data visualization expert Ben Fry, the group also created a dashboard that could display data generated during the simulation, including contact tracing data and the number of people infected and vaccinated. The tools we made for the app are the same tools we're creating for outbreaks around the world. Students are working with best-in-class technology, Sabeti says. Operation Outbreak is free to use and has been played by school children from Shanghai and Sierra Leone to Paris and Toronto. Organizers can choose from a variety of possible pathogens to simulate, from coronaviruses and measles to Marburg virus and tuberculosis. Keon Sani, Operation Outbreak's chief of staff, says the hope is to bring the simulation, the simulation to more professional groups in the near future, including public health departments, first responders, and companies that might want to bolster their employees' outbreak preparedness. Teachers who've organized the game say they like the simulation because, though outbreak science is not typically taught in schools, it complements what students are already learning about biology and civics. It helps kids understand the science behind vaccines and being sick and how research works, but also it is a great pipeline for careers because they get to learn about different career paths, says Nicole Kellerman, a biology teacher who has organized Operation Outbreak simulations in two Maryland high schools. Carlisle, the 16-year-old who took part in the Operation Outbreak simulation in Utah, was surprised by how much she enjoyed the game. I thought it would be weird, just this thing you would play on your phone. But it was actually neat to see this virus spreading really quickly in this whole city that was created, she says. Along with about 70 of her classmates, Carlisle, a junior at Utah's Lehigh High School, played the game at Utah Valley University, UVU, in Orem, October 3rd. About 30 college students also took part. Micah Ross, an assistant professor of biology at UVU, who organized the simulation, says that despite some turmoil, the students managed the outbreak well. The biomedical researchers cracked the mystery of the pathogen's identity. It was influenza in just 40 minutes. Once a vaccine was introduced, most students chose to get immunized, and the spread of the disease slowed. Ross says the game helps students become more scientifically literate and can also be a useful research tool. She co-leads a research group at UVU and runs a class every year in which students are encouraged to use Operation Outbreak as a way to collect and analyze novel data. Her research group is currently working on a study probing whether certain demographic factors influence participants' decision-making in simulations conducted in Utah. We are curious if there are some decisions that are made more often, say, down south, that are not made by populations up north. What leads people to getting vaccinated? What factors may cause them not to get tested? Ross says, noting that the outcome of the study could help inform public health policy. Exposure to Operation Outbreak has prompted many of her students to pursue career paths in public health or research, Ross says. It also helps students become a little more confident in their ability to relate to what is happening in the world and say, hey, I've been in that position, even if only for an hour. That was A Losing Game by Dominique Mossbergen, Orem, Utah. Under the heading Nation, what the LA fires reveal about America's bleak climate future. Distress Signal is the title of this article by Justin Warland, Altadena, California. With reporting by Leslie Dickstein. Looking back, my elementary school experience felt almost bucolic. My classmates and I ran around St. Mark's School's 5.5-acre campus, carefree. With classrooms opening to the outdoors, we sat outside for lunch in the shadow of the San Gabriel Mountains and feared being sent to the administration building, a two-story house converted into offices. The smell of burning forest was a recognizable, if not frequent, occurrence. Teachers would cancel recess. Lunch was moved inside from the patio, an annoyance no more ominous than a rainy day. When I visited in February, just a month after the Eaton fire had ripped through the town of Altadena, California, the campus had been transformed. For the most part, the buildings were gone. A chimney from the old house remained standing. A stairwell that once led from the ground floor of the art barn to offices upstairs had become a stairwell from nowhere to nowhere. And somehow amid the rubble sat the same blue and yellow tables where I hung out nearly three decades prior. In September, I visited St. Mark's again. The campus had been cleared of debris, the result of a cleanup effort that the state touts as the fastest in history, and the site now looks like a giant dirt patch, waiting for construction to begin. In the interim, the school relocated to a corner of a high school 2 miles southeast. It is at once a hopeful and devastating sight. Modular trailers have been placed at the edge of campus. Children are playing on a hastily constructed play set. Amid the faculty walking around, I spot a few familiar faces who greet me with hugs and nostalgia. And the blue and yellow tables have been moved to a patio at the center of campus. When we opened this facility, the kids cried. They were like, "Those are our tables," Jennifer Tolbert, head of school, told me as we walked on the new campus. Tolbert is resilient. She talks about how the fire has forced the school to innovate. She says it can emerge from tragedy stronger. But Tolbert, whose home also burned in the fire, acknowledges the uphill battle ahead. Enrollment has declined by a third, and it will be years before a rebuild can be completed, assuming she can raise the necessary funds. The school did not plan for an event of this magnitude. No one did. The Eaton fire, much like the Palisades fire that simultaneously ripped through another Los Angeles community 25 miles away, was at once shocking and entirely predictable. Fires are a constant threat in Southern California, and recent climatic conditions mean even steeper challenges than normal. Last year, the region slipped into a drought after 2 years of heavy rainfall. So in January, there was dead tinder ready to burn. These conditions persist today. It is exactly the sort of erratic environment that comes with a warming planet. Combine the dry vegetation with high wind speeds, typical for January, and disaster awaits. But it is precisely those factors that make the fires so shocking. A foreseeable event for any climatologist, yet apparently not for the officials charged with protecting the community. Firefighters were stretched thin, hydrants ran dry, and evacuation notices came too late. I made my first trip to L.A. 2 days after the fire started, landing at LAX Airport to the shriek of emergency alerts buzzing on phones across the cabin, and staying at a hotel packed with a mix of first responders, evacuees, and media. Since then, I've made 7 more trips to L.A. to track the recovery and spend time in Altadena, the Pacific Palisades, and the places in between where decisions are being made. It has become clear that if the initial response was botched, then the recovery has been interminably slow. As the process drags, a leadership vacuum has emerged. The state says the federal government needs to disperse funds to help cover the bills, as it has in past disasters. The federal government says the state needs to take responsibility. Local government is divided between centers of gravity. In this context, business and nonprofit leaders business and nonprofit leaders are trying to address a challenge of unprecedented scale. With no one in the driver's seat, communities, residents, local business owners, school principals even, have been left to navigate a web of challenges. The January fires, that's last January, that hit Los Angeles are, when taken together, among the costliest disasters in U.S. history, with some estimates of the economic toll topping $250 billion. Some 16,000 structures were destroyed, and at peak, 200,000 people were hit with evacuation orders and warnings. More than 30 people died. Yet the fires have become a distant memory on the national agenda, just as happened with recent events stretching from North Carolina to Texas. As climate-related disasters accelerate and compound across the country, communities of all political stripes, socioeconomic compositions, and racial backgrounds face new risks. The best way to protect against this is to take action beforehand, investing in programs that help cities prevent and prepare. an approach known in climate circles as adaptation. When disaster does strike, the government needs to embrace a new framework for recovery that moves swiftly without leading to rebuilding the exact same way. The recovery in Los Angeles is an opportunity to create a new model for a climate-resilient future. The jury's still out on whether this is possible, and the evidence is not looking good. The L.A. fires and their aftermath should serve as a warning sign for us all. Here's a photo, about a quarter of a page. It's the patio with the blue tables and yellow benches at St. Mark's School in Altadena, California, shortly after the fire hit. Well, the tables are circular. Each table has a folded, right now, yellow umbrella embedded in it. Around it are, I think four semicircular benches. They're in yellow. And in the background, among other things, is a stairway that leads to nowhere. Back to the text. In an age of instant communication, my first whiff of the Eaton fire came through an old-fashioned phone tree, a call from my brother in New York to say that a fire had been spotted in the foothills a few miles from our childhood home, and our parents were preparing to evacuate. For months following, my mother kept recounting the details of that night. The initial disbelief, the difficulty navigating an evacuation amid a blackout, and the regret for the lifetime of family memorabilia she could not save. While their house, my childhood home, burned to the ground, my parents were among the lucky ones. Our home was located east of Lake Avenue, the thoroughfare that divides east and west Altadena, in an area where notifications came early in the evening. A notice to prepare to evacuate, followed by an evacuation order. On the other side, where many Black and Latino families had bought homes when redlining kept them out of other neighborhoods, residents went to bed with no indication of the approaching danger. Evacuation orders began at 3:25 a.m., at which point many homes had already caught fire. Residents banged on their neighbors' doors. 19 people died in the Eaton fire, all but one of whom lived west of Lake. We never got any calls from the sheriff. We never saw a fireman, says Lynn Ann Hansen Miller, an artist whose home is one of the few still standing on her block. It was really the encouragement of our neighbors that got us to evacuate. With no one enforcing any restrictions on movement, many residents returned in the morning to see for themselves, sending videos and photos to friends and neighbors. Firefighters stood by perplexed as homes burned because fire hydrants had no water, the result of low water pressure caused by stress on the system. Emergency vehicles zoomed with sirens blasting. The scene was framed by a fog of thick, toxic smoke. How the fire was managed may be considered an original sin that sowed distrust and made the recovery much harder. Lawsuits related to that night abound, and some residents have gone as far as harassing firefighters, the typical heroes of any emergency, on the street. Ahead of Halloween, a diorama on an Altadena property displayed a series of skeletons holding signs like "Fire Department Failed Altadena." Over and over, victims I spoke with kept coming back to the horror of that night and the government failure. Even when our conversation had moved on, neither the Palisades nor Altadena was a rogue frontier settlement. How could they be left to burn? The frustration is not just anecdotal. An independent report about both fires commissioned by Los Angeles County offered damning conclusion after damning conclusion. The Office of Emergency Management was under-resourced. The county's policy on evacuation warnings was unclear. And first responders relied on old tech that left them with outdated information and unable to communicate with each other reliably. Local officials speak of the unique challenges of the night, the high wind, multiple fires that stretched resources thin, and so on. But no one offers a full-throated defense of the initial response. We did not have the technology or the staffing to meet the needs of how catastrophic this fire was. Catherine Barger, county supervisor who represents Altadena, put it to me bluntly. The notifications were a failure. At a national or even global level, a rich body of literature shows that a relatively small investment to adapt to the effects of climate change pays enormous dividends. Exact numbers vary, but some estimates suggest that a dollar invested in resilience can result in up to $10 in avoided costs and economic benefits. But even in high-risk places, these investments tend to be placed on the back burner. It's hard to cut a ribbon on training for fighting wildfires. And when all is going well, the public is not demanding it. In L.A., the cost of additional firefighter training, early warning systems, and improved water infrastructure would have saved billions, not to mention lives, disruption, and heartache. In September, I drove up Lake Avenue to meet Shauna Dawson Beer, one of the most outspoken locals spearheading recovery ideas. At first, the storefronts conveyed a staged sense of normality, not too different from what I remember growing up. But as I kept driving, the view quickly transformed into a tattered landscape of cleared lots and lingering debris. The homes on Dawson Beer's block just west of Lake were all gone. Though on the corner, two women carried on a normal conversation, as if they had just bumped into each other on a neighborhood stroll. On Dawson Beer's lot, the first inklings of apple trees were sprouting up from the cleared dirt. Dawson Beer, who runs a private Facebook group for Altadena residents that counts more than 10,000 members, has an extensive list of fixes that she thinks will help the area regain its footing, from soil testing to ensure the land is not laced with toxic contaminants to new financing structures to help people afford to rebuild. But perhaps her most important idea is a call for Altadena to become an independent city, a tall order at any time, but especially in the midst of fire recovery. To effectively build back, she says, Altadena must break free from the existing power structure. We need to steer our own ship, she tells me. The destruction of Altadena spawned an array of advocates and activists. Altadena was a diverse community, home to everyone from self-proclaimed starving artists to white shoe corporate lawyers. Many NASA scientists called the town home, thanks to the Jet Propulsion Laboratory nearby. In some areas, multiple generations occupied small single-family homes that had been in the family for decades. Elsewhere, giant mansions sat within walking distance to the local country club. Unsurprisingly, views about what the recovery should look like vary widely. At the Home State Taco Shop, part of a commercial strip a few blocks away from any visible fire damage, I met Ollie Rachel Pearl, an assistant professor who is leading a nonprofit community land trust that works with another nonprofit to turn properties into new housing, green space, or commercial spaces that meet local needs. And for owners who feel forced to sell, the organization helps keep land locally owned. So far, however, two-thirds of properties sold have been bought by investors, according to research from UCLA. To me, the North Star is anti-displacement, she says. After attending a fire recovery meeting, I chatted with Joy Chen about the Eaton Fire Survivors Network. Chen, an Altadena resident who formerly worked as a deputy mayor in the city of Los Angeles, founded the group to advocate for fire victims and quickly focused on insurance issues. Few policies covered the full cost of rebuilding. The consequence of rising construction costs and policies that did not adjust. Many victims say insurance companies are taking too long to pay out. Others say insurers are shortchanging them. To me, a healthy insurance market requires that companies honor their contracts, says Chen. Other activists are targeting issues with soil remediation. Officials say they completed the cleanup in record time. Locals complain that the government was less comprehensive in its efforts to test the soil for toxic materials than it had been in past disasters. A different group focuses on resources for renters who've slipped through the cracks of many recovery programs. Another helps equip small businesses with the means to reopen. Even for someone intimately familiar with the texture of the community, it can be hard to keep track of the proliferation of ideas, organizations, and approaches in the wake of the fires. This dynamic is a reflection of both the community's diversity and a widely shared commitment to a locally led rebuilding effort. Without a doubt, the influx of philanthropic support to local organizations, tens of millions of dollars in a matter of weeks after the fire, has also helped sustain the various efforts. But it's also the result of a lack of institutional leadership. As a census-designated, unincorporated community, Altadena has no mayor. Its population before the fire hovered around 43,000. Barger, the most prominent elected official, represents 2 million people across the county and lives in a different city a few miles away. And yet, even the Palisades, which, unlike Altadena, is part of the city of Los Angeles, faces similar challenges. It is one dot on the western edge of the city. And there, too, power is distributed between city and county authorities. Powerful locals with Palisades connections, including Rick Caruso, a billionaire real estate developer who ran against Mayor Karen Bass in the last election, create a whole different set of fractured power dynamics. The challenge of Los Angeles's balkanized governance is no secret to local leadership. A few months after the fire, a group of local leaders on a blue ribbon commission proposed by the county supervisor representing the Palisades released a report that suggested creating a unified authority to coordinate rebuilding across the county. The authority could help arrange bulk purchase of materials, create new finance mechanisms to facilitate the rebuild, and even buy property across affected locales, thereby keeping the bottom from falling out. And the report called for the city and county to adopt climate adaptation measures to ensure the affected areas are prepared for future disasters. It really was a vision for what our entire region could look like in terms of a resilient and fire-safe recovery, says Matt Peterson, head of the Los Angeles Clean Tech Incubator, who chaired the commission. The recommendations were perhaps too visionary. Bass opposed creating a new entity. Barger opposed an effort in Sacramento to authorize it, but said she supported the idea of a rebuilding authority structured differently. In the meantime, they both worked to expedite permitting. The city of Los Angeles is accelerating permitting for fire area projects and expediting pre-approved home plans. The county has set up one-stop help desks and waived fees. Where I've been laser-focused is looking at where the impediments are, where the barriers are, and addressing them, says Barger. New construction will inevitably be built to higher fire standards. Some homes destroyed across Los Angeles were built as early as the 1920s, and the building code has since required fire-resistant materials. The relevant jurisdictions are also enforcing a policy that requires keeping landscaping away from structures. But is that enough? Rebuilding LA offers an opportunity to be truly proactive and creative when it comes to climate adaptation. Yet that sort of deep thinking is still not at the center of how most people are talking about recovery. Nationally, much of the coverage of this year's fires has boiled down to two simple narratives. In the Palisades, wealthy celebrities lost their homes. In Altadena, middle-income black and brown people with less means to get back on their feet lost their homes. There are elements of truth to these narratives. Climate-related events will always be harder to weather for those with fewer resources. But I sometimes fear these narratives obscure an important reality. Climate disaster will strike everywhere. Whatever protection you may think you have, it is best to think again. To maintain a healthy society in the time of climate crisis, someone needs to take the wheel. While the day-to-day of insurance, soil, and fire planning occupy headlines, the bigger picture has been lost. Climate change may not be an existential threat in the sense it will kill us all, but it is existential for the cultural fabric of communities, and climate disasters threaten to bring about political and social fragmentation for the growing number of people affected by them. It won't be known until 3 or 4 years from now, when reality sets in, says Sachs, when people look around and say, all these communities existed, and now they're all gone. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.